It's quite profound and poetic and lovely, interspersed with all the fart jokes as well.
I think a lot of the clients that I've taken on Kokoda, they talk about the trip, but they also talk about the preparation and how proud they are of themselves that they actually got to the starting line.
Old, new, borrowed, blue.
On ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
Your guest tonight is Dr. Robert Parker, the president of the AMA in the NT. A title he's held for about 6 years now, but he's been calling the territory home since 77. And it wasn't medicine that brought him to the top end. It was as a student on an archaeological dig in Kakadu. It was the dry season and it was spectacular. He was hooked. It was after he'd made the move north that his interest in Aboriginal health prompted him to return to study medicine. For old, new, borrowed, blue, his old song is Faces, Pool Hall Richard. Good evening, Robert.
Good evening.
Where does that song take you?
Well, it takes me back. I'm a child of the 60s and 70s. What I really like about it is it's really rough rock and roll with Rod Stewart before he got all prettied up. And it's sort of good basic rock and roll, which was pretty much the standard fare when I was growing up in Sydney in the 60s and 70s, before it all became too technical.
Do you remember the first time you heard that song or that kind of music when that was happening?
Yeah, I just really enjoyed it. He was really enjoying himself, and I particularly like the bit where the glass breaks at the end. And I love the line, he's broken my heart because he's stolen my tart. I think you don't get a lot of that in music these days.
No, you don't. Somebody would probably object to it.
That's right, too politically correct.
So that's the music that you wanted to listen to. Before you were taking control of the music in the house, what were your parents and your other family members exposing you to?
Well, actually, it was interesting. My father bought a gramophone record in the 60s. He was a great fan of classical music and would always listen to classical music. And there'd always be classical music on in the evenings. He'd be listening to ABC Classical or putting on. And there was a very – so I think he bought the original record player. He didn't believe in stereo because he said the music comes from one source. You don't need two speakers. You need a single speaker. But he very kindly, when he bought the first record player for the house, bought a couple of Beatles singles so that we had some input as well.
Yeah, very nice. What were those songs?
I think I Want to Hold Your Hand or something. Like, it was really early Beatles.
Yep.
But it was nice that he thought about us as well.
It was Faces after Small Faces, is that right?
I think the Small Faces were a separate group. I think Faces were different to Small. So Faces was different to Small Faces, and I think Faces was the first group that Rob Stewart worked with before he then became really famous. Obviously, he had great talent and went way beyond his original stuff for the Faces. But he was obviously having a good time as a young rock and roller.
And listening to this music at home, were you going to see any of it in Sydney?
Unfortunately, I did go and see some live stuff around Sydney. There was a place called the Roxy, which was in Taylor Square, and I used to go up there at night. It was really good, actually. You'd turn up about 10 o'clock at night, and all the other musos who'd been doing live music would stop and actually come to the Roxy for a coffee or a drink after they finished. And quite often, you had really good original blues players such as Gypsy Dave Smith and Jim Jarvis, who'd be actually doing songs. And you actually had people like Tommy Emmanuel sitting in the audience, listening to Dave Smith play. It was a good time.
You know you're in the right spot when that's where the other musos are going to listen to music.
That's right, yeah. And it was good. It was good sort of blues. It was mainly blues. I've always been a blues sort of guy. So it was mainly blues, but it was a good spot to hang out.
And was that a sort of formal setting they were performing, or was it more of a jam?
It was a formal setting. I was actually very lucky. Dave was a really good blues player. In fact, he picked up a dobro and then went travelling. He's actually now resident in Liverpool, or no, Newcastle in the United Kingdom. But he picked up his dobro, which enhanced his musical style, and then took off just apparently being a travelling troubadour through Asia, worked his way up to the UK where he became a born-again Christian. But, he would play and other people would just listen because he had a really good slide style and people just enjoyed that.
And what did your father, who was into the classical music, what did he think of the blues stuff when you were bringing that home?
Well, he didn't. I mean, I kept my blues sort of stuff away from him. I don't think he would have enjoyed it that much. But he loved classical. He grew up with classical. I don't think the blues was a was a particular strong point for him.
Is that maybe where some of the appeal came for you?
In terms of Revolution, no, I got on very well with my father. In fact, it was quite interesting. Dad was an artist. I've still got some of his paintings on my wall. He married late in life and was lucky because my mum was a physiotherapist. My brother, who's a year younger than me, had cerebral palsy. So being mature individuals, I mean, a lot of their life was spent looking after my brother, making sure he was properly cared for. And they gave us a very good home life. So I had no major sort of revolutionary ideals about getting away from the parents. But they were both really good people.
Was your dad making art? Like, were you exposed to that in the house? Were you doing that as well?
Well, no, he was a commercial artist. So he had particular projects he worked on for other people. But I think he bought a particular artistic sensibility. Like he bought me and my brothers up with a particular appreciation of the contribution of arts to society. And we'd often discuss artists. He'd often get us to review artists and, you know, the great artists and look at the contribution they made. And so I think we were very lucky to have had that sort of influence.
And most people will recognise you and recognise your name from the AMANT and your medical profession, but that's not where it started out for you.
That's right. I originally, in fact, my whole life hinged on one mark in the HSC. I missed out on arts law by one mark.
Oh.
So I ended up doing arts at Sydney Uni, and I ended up doing anthropology and prehistoric archaeology. So if I got that one mark, I might have ended up being a boring solicitor in Sydney, but I ended up doing prehistoric archaeology. I ended up working in an Aboriginal art gallery as well, just doing a bit of cash while I was at uni. And I turned up in the Territory in 77 to do a archaeological dig out in East Alligator. We were actually camped on Jabaluka Billabong and swimming in the Billabong after the dig, which you couldn't do these days. We were digging a site near Ubia. And it was a lot of fun. I just really enjoyed the Territory. And shortly after I got back to Sydney, I heard about a job on the Tiwis doing Aboriginal art and craft. So I ended up working there for 3 years.
So that first trip and that time spent, that was your first visit to the Territory, that dig?
That's right, spending a month out on Kakadu, camped next to Jabaluka Billabong, going out to the escarpment every day, you know, looking at Aboriginal rock art.
Was it dry, the dry season?
Yeah, it was a late dry.
Yeah.
And, but yeah,
would have been a good sell.
It was excellent. It was really nice, yeah.
Be hard to imagine going back to life in sweaty grey Sydney.
That's right. It wasn't, yeah, it was just, I saw opportunities up here. And followed them. It was good.
That one mark for your HSC, was that in a particular subject or was that the total?
No, I
stuffed one point away.
I stuffed a mathematical calculus question and I actually realised when I left the exam room.
Oh, no.
And I'd stuffed it up. You know, if I got that one, if I'd done the calculus thing, I would have had a totally different life. It's very interesting.
Look, I'm pleased to say that you were obviously a good student, that you realised when you were leaving, so you can hold your head up high about actually getting that right. But I think things worked out for the best for you.
Probably, yeah.
Were you gutted by that? Is that really what you had your heart set on, doing arts law, or was it just what sounded right?
No, again, I think my dad, you know, he regarded an arts degree as a really good thing to do because, again, it sort of, he believed it gave an intellectual appreciation of society. So he was quite happy I was an
artist. So nice to hear a nice review of an arts degree. So often it's just belittled and joked about, would you like fries with that?
Well, again, it was a really interesting time to be at Sydney Uni as well because the Vietnam War had just finished. There was a lot of student activity, a lot of sort of revolutionary activity going on around the uni. So it was a really quite exciting place to be. I think the Vice Chancellor's office was occupied at various times, which wasn't a bit, I can't really approve of that. But anyway, it was an interesting place to be because of all the, I suppose, the intellectual activity around the uni as much as in the courses.
And so how did you settle on your majors to study anthropology and prehistoric archaeology?
Well, I think when I ended up doing an arts degree, I decided I wasn't going to do anything I did at school. So basically I ended up doing, I think, archaeology, anthropology, archaeology. I did philosophy. I think I did government, which is sort of like politics and political stuff, just to do something, now for something completely different.
Things that weren't offered in high school. Now, for me, I studied archaeology as part of my arts degree as well, but there was very little Australian archaeology as part of that course. I was at Melbourne Uni and I think Monash had a fairly decent program, but I wasn't going to leave the beautiful lawn in the city. So how was that? Did Sydney Uni offer a pretty good Australian study?
Well, it was a really exciting time to be at Sydney Uni because some of the great people in anthropology and archaeology, some of the people that established the profession, both for anthropology and archaeology in Australia, were resident at the uni or visiting. So people like John Peter White, who was one of my lecturers, a very inspirational sort of guy. John Mulvaney, who set up archaeology at the ANU. Some of the anthropologists, Les Hyatt, a guy that had worked at Maningrida. I can't remember his name, but he'd done some really important work at Maningrida at looking at establishment of tribal patterns and whatever. So, I mean, it was a really interesting time to be there with some of the sort of foundation people, and it was great, really enjoyed it.
And was a lot of that study and that subject of Australian archaeology, was it talking about Northern Australia?
Yes. Well, I mean, yeah, that's right, because most of the work had been done. Although there was a guy who had done a lot of good work in Tasmania as well.
Okay.
But he had actually done a lot of his archaeological work in Tasmania, particularly looking at the extermination of the Tasmanian Aboriginal population and looked at sites. So that was really quite inspirational, because it was a pretty appalling time in Australian history for this guy to be working. And I think his work then also influenced the subsequent issue with the Tasmanian rivers, because a number of the sites that he'd worked on were actually threatened by the dams. So I think they became part of the Greens movement in Tasmania. So that was really interesting as well.
And was that learning about what was known then from archaeology of Aboriginal culture, was that eye-opening for you, or was it something that you and your family were more aware of than perhaps a lot of mainstream society?
Well, what was really interesting, again, I mean, it really opened my eyes to the complexity of Aboriginal society and culture. I mean, I think when we were at school, we were just taught that Aboriginal people, we like had a 10-minute session on Aboriginal people. They were basically hunter-gatherers with very rudimentary skills and, you know, until they were taken over by the superior white culture. Don't forget, this was in the 1960s.
Oh, it was still what was being taught in the 80s.
That's right. But then, you know, there was another archaeologist called Harry Larandos, who was working at Sydney Uni at the time, and he'd done some work in Victoria that actually found that Aboriginal people were farming eels. So they had almost established villages and were farming eels in the area with ditches and dams. So it obviously showed a complexity of Indigenous culture that was well beyond sort of the stuff that was portrayed in the school textbooks. And that was really good in its own right.
Have you read Dark Emu?
No, not yet.
It's on my list too.
I mean, one of the really interesting things I did in my degree, in the fourth year I did an honours degree, and I actually looked at the Aboriginal ecology of Central Australia and looked at the way I had to do that was actually read all the early explorer accounts of people traversing through Central Australia, some of which were incredibly interesting. I mean, John McDill Stewart, for example, wrote, I think, the first Whitefella account of Uluru. McDill Stewart, interesting man, very complex man, but he was very economical in what he wrote about. And I think he was the first guy to do the south-north traverse of Australia. And generally each page was like, each day was about two or three lines, spinifex, more dam spinifex, whatever. but when he came to Uluru, he actually came on it after a storm, and he sort of emerged out of the desert to find this enormous rock with water pouring off it. And, you know, it was about three pages full of writing about his impressions of this amazing spectacle that he'd just come across in the middle of the desert. So, you know, it was a real privilege to have read that sort of material as well.
And were they reprints, or were you locked away in the depths of some state library to peruse those?
Sydney Uni, which I was at, has got a very good rare books library. And a lot of the first editions of the Explorer accounts are in that library. So I was actually able to read the first editions of the, and again, I was reading day to day what they were doing, who they were coming across as though. And again, they were some of the best accounts of where people were, how many there were, what time of year it was, what resources, which is why I was looking at it. Mm. Yeah, they were good.
Rebecca McLaren.
A very good show.
On ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
Joined by Dr. Robert Parker for Old, New, Borrowed, Blue. It's time for another song. Robert, what have you chosen for new? And I have to say, when I first looked at this, I thought, oh, he's picked a strange German song.
Well, this is actually a song by Joe Strummer. It was only released 2 years ago, and I think it's Joe Strummer, before he was in The Clash, was in a group called the 101ers. So technically it is an old song, but it's new because it was only, I think, they produced a collection of Joe Strummer's music about a year or two ago, and this was one of the songs in it. But it's a particularly striking song, I thought. So being an old blues guy, I thought that was a reasonable to have it as a new song.
And the title is all stuck together, all one word.
That's right.
Like it would be your email login or something at the moment. What is it about this one? What should we listen to in particular?
I think it's just a challenge. Joe Strummer was a very good musician. I mean, The Clash had a major influence on me. Again, something just attracted me to The Clash. And again, one of the great nights of my life was going to their live concert in Sydney when they did the Magnificent Seven tour. They were a particularly good band. They were a very good live band. And when I was on the Tiwis, I was working with a bunch of really talented other craft advisors such as Colin Little and Ray Young, who were pretty radical. That actually worked in the tin sheds at Sydney Uni doing a whole lot of rather left-wing community posters. And there was the time of Margaret Thatcher. There was a lot of political stuff going on in the UK that we were aware of. And The Clash just seemed to really fit into that. I mean, The Clash are a punk band, but they're an intelligent punk band. It was quite interesting because when Bob Dylan wrote his autobiography recently, he said one of the guitarists he really wanted to work with was Mick Jones, who's the guitarist in The Clash. Oh. So they produced really good music as well as being a very strong sort of political voice. When I got back to Sydney, they did a movie called Rude Boy, which was actually a sort of quasi-documentary about the Clash on tour through England. I took my brother, again, in his wheelchair to see. We were in the New Art Cinema in Glebe, and there was so much energy in the film. There's actually a fight broke out a couple of rows ahead of us. I thought, this is when a band can produce this much energy and you get a riot in the movie, this is pretty good. So I've been a great fan of The Clash and Joe Strummer for a long time.
Let's get a bit of rockin'. It's all one word, so that's what you need to know about that song, your new song for Old New Borrowed Blue with Dr. Robert Parker, President of the AMANT here on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory. That's a cool song I've never heard, Robert. Thank you.
My pleasure.
It's always, always great to have something that I didn't know about brought in, which happens a lot in this segment, I must say.
Good.
It's always delightful. You mentioned going to see The Clash and spending time watching live music at the Roxy in Sydney. When you were then living in the Northern Territory, and on the Tiwis in particular, did you find a different kind of live music?
Well, again, it was interesting. I arrived, I think, on Bathurst in 77, just after Elvis had died. And there was a lot of grief because Elvis was really big on the Tiwis in the 70s, so they were going through a grief issue. I mean, it was interesting because, again, the whole issue of music, I was really lucky again to be in Tiwi at a time when there was a group of old carvers I worked with who'd had a long history back in the Tiwis. So as an example, I mean, one of the carvers I had who was a great privilege to work with was a guy called Declan Apiotimi. And Declan was a marvellous man. He was a very good carver. He had a wicked sense of humour and he was a real character. And we used to get regular VIPs visiting the island. And I was with him one day and an Indonesian general turned up with his wife and we were sort of standing there and Declan just walked up and started conversing with the general in fluent Bahasa. And the general was amazed. The wife had to be picked off the floor. But basically what had happened was Declan, as a young boy, had been picked up on a Japanese fishing boat and taken up and spent about 2 years sitting on the Straits of Malacca doing pearling. And that's where he'd become very familiar with Indonesians and Bahasa. There was another guy, Bertram Cantilla, who, when I was on the island, he was up the north of the island and his father saw Japanese planes flying over. So this was a group who hadn't had any contact with so-called whitefellas. And his father wondered what these planes were all about. So he got to Bertram to get in a canoe and go down to the mission. They knew the mission was there, but hadn't had any contact with it. And go down and actually talk to the, to find out what these planes were about with the mission. So that was the sort of people I was dealing with. It had a tremendous sort of history before, of the 20th century, before a lot of white contact. It was a really interesting time to be there. And the Tiwis used to have, obviously, their own musical stuff. They had the Pukamani ceremonies, and I was very lucky. There was a guy called Charlie Purantana Mary who was up at Purlinginbi, then called Garden Point, and his son had died in very tragic circumstances. So he wanted to actually do the right thing for his son, and he had the last really big Pukamani ceremony that I remember. Maybe anyone remembers on the island. And generally, most of the Pukamanis when I were there, you'd have one Pukamani pole and a bit of dancing, but he really wanted to do the right thing. So he commissioned, I think, 12 carvers to carve. And the ceremony went over a whole weekend. And so there was a particular sort of, that was dancing, and they basically lined the poles up, had a shade cloth made of palm fronds, and people just sat under the shade cloth, and people would take turns to dance. And it went right through the day, right through the night. There was the whole community just got into it. And it was a really interesting time to observe sort of traditional Tiwi music. And the other one was the Kalama ceremony. The Kalama ceremony was usually held in April or May when the Kalama yam became ripe. Wow. And the old Tiwi people would basically get together and sing songs, the Kalama songs. So you get a bunch of Tiwi elders sitting around singing songs. My boss then was Rafa Lapiotimi, who was a marvellous man. He was a real product of history in the territory. I think he'd worked with Ted Egan. He'd played football with Ted Egan. He actually in the end got an Order of Australia for his contribution to arts, and he couldn't wear it on his bare skin, so he actually got a T-shirt made up with his Order of Australia screen printed on, so he could wear his T-shirt with his Order of Australia. But he was an incredibly wise, generous man. And it was a lot of fun just to sit down watching him do Kalama with some of the other old people. So I was aware of, you know, Tiwi music as much as, you know, Tiwi's getting into rock and roll and Elvis Presley when I was there.
Do you remember when you first arrived on the island, when you first stepped off the boat or the plane?
Yeah, I didn't. There isn't a Tiwi design. I mean, that's where I met the craft advisor, who was about to leave, a guy called Mike Pearson, and I got to know a lot of the young Tiwi guys. They're all about my age, so we all sort of grew up together, and I still catch up with a number of them every now and then, and we all sort of reminisce about the old days. I think, again, the standing joke was I used to have to cut trees down as part of my work on the island, and Danny Mankara, who's still there, remembers a time when I had to take the schoolboys out to they had to be taught carving as well, we used a timber called ironwood, cooked down ironwood, which was an incredibly hard, resilient timber. And it was a real tribute to the carvers that they could work with it. But because it was so strong, they could do marvellous things so you could have very small amounts of timber holding up other parts of the carving. But with the bloodwood, it was much easier timber to work with. So we got some for the schoolboys. And Danny always remembers the time I took the schoolboys out and I said confidently to them, look, the tree's going to fall this way, guys. And the first cut went okay, but the second cut didn't. So basically the tree fell backwards and everyone jumped out of the way. And after the dust had settled and everyone sort of picked them, no one was injured, but everyone was sort of covered in dust and twigs. And so that was my enduring legacy, Rob Parker and his tree felling skills. So, yeah, Danny continues to remind me of that whenever I see him.
I'm sure it's a good story for those that survived the Rob Parker tree felling incident. Why did you leave island life?
Oh, I just got inspired. There was a doctor called Pat Rabgetts, who was a marvellous man. Again, he always had a mission to work with Aboriginal people, and he'd train in Queensland, come up to work in Darwin, and he'd basically guaranteed the Tiwi people that he'd be the first doctor on the island, which he was. Anyway, Pat used to pop over and I used to catch up with him, and he really inspired me in terms of the commitment he made to medicine and what he was actually doing with medicine and Aboriginal culture. So it seemed like a really good, I decided at that time to make a change in career and see if I could get into medicine to follow Pat's footsteps.
And you didn't miss out by one mark this time?
No, it took me a couple of goes to get into to Newcastle, but I finally got in, and it's been a superb career. Really enjoyed it. It's been obviously been a very interesting career.
And how old were you when you made that change?
I got into Newcastle in 83, so I would have been about 29, I think, at the time.
Any hesitation at, you know, that point in life to say, I'm going to go back and be a student?
No, in fact, it was because I was really interested in it, and the Newcastle course was really interesting as well. I mean, traditional medical courses basically had blocks of material like histology, pathology, microbiology or whatever. But Newcastle integrated the whole lot. So, and David Madison, who set the Newcastle course up, was a psychiatrist, and the whole purpose of Newcastle was to encourage communication with patients. So what they found was in the old days you'd have 3 years of pre-med where you'd be doing all histology, anatomy and whatever, and then you'd suddenly be doing 3 years of clinical work, and quite a few really bright people had really enjoyed the histology and anatomy, suddenly found themselves on an end-stage ward with someone who was coughing their lungs out into a sputum cup, and they wondered, really, what do I want to be here? You know, so David Madison said, look, we're going to throw you into the deep end. You're going to be in wards from day one.
Ah.
And if you don't like it, get out. You know, that's not your career. So from pretty much, we had what's called an integrated curriculum. So you'd actually study someone with a broken leg, but you'd actually then look at the pathology of bone, the anatomy of the leg, the pathology of bone, the issues about inflammation. So you look at everything as a group, and then you'd be going off to the wards and making patients cups of tea and sort of sitting talking to patients. So it was a really interesting course.
Does that help with that whole patient treatment? Because often if you just fix someone's broken leg, you haven't fixed how that happened or why that why that happened as well.
Well, everyone in Newcastle had to go through communication modules. So even if you wanted to be a surgeon or a radiologist, you still had to pass Communication 101. And we actually had two communication ones. We had sexual health issues, which was quite amusing at times, and also giving bad news, which was less amusing, but also very important in terms of communication. So we actually had to be examined in those areas. And again, so everyone, no matter what your, and certainly people, and some people in medicine, better communicating than others, but everyone at Newcastle had to pass those blocks.
And then you chose to focus on psychiatry.
Well, I sort of fell into psychiatry by accident more than design. I basically, I ended up in Darwin because my wife's Tiwi and she wanted to be back here. And I basically did medicine, surgery, orthopaedics and psychiatry during my intern year. And during my psychiatry, Dr. Joan Ridley, who the Joan Ridley unit is named after, was still the director of mental health. And we had a ward at that stage, Ward 9, which had some long-stay patients in it, all Indigenous. And Dr. Ridley and I used to come down and visit them, and we'd be talking. And Dr. Ridley was very interested in my background in anthropology. And so she actually offered me a registrar job in my second year. But I wanted to go off and do other things in medicine before I did psychiatry. So I went off and did paediatrics and anaesthetics and obstetrics and did a term in Catherine, where I ended up going down as a third-year resident and ended up as medical superintendent for a week. So you sort of had a whole range of really interesting experiences. But then I realised over those 3 years, that one of the things I was actually quite good at was talking to people. It was a skill that I had. I just approached Dr. Ridley to see if she had a job as a registrar, and I was fortunate there was a job going, so I sort of ended up as a psychiatrist.
Given those great experiences that you had because you were in the Territory, why do you think it's hard sometimes for us to attract medical staff to come and work here?
I don't know. I think, again, talking to a journal the other day about it. Part of the problem is the partner and the mortgage. You know, I was lucky that I got a Tiwi partner, and, you know, we ended up having a mortgage in Darwin, so it made it easy. And I think there's a changing nature of medical culture. In the old days, I mean, as I said, the old medical courses, you get people straight out of high school into medicine, and you probably didn't get married or whatever in medicine, so you'd end up being single in the hospital system. So it was really quite easy in the old days. You just were sent bush to do stuff. It was just part of the rotations, and you ended up with young people going bush and doing things. And then you'd come back to town, find the partner, have the kids, education, you know. So what you'd find is that there were the people who tended to be attracted to more remote and rural medicine for the first time, rather the really young people or the sort of grey nomad types who are at the end of their career, who got through the mortgage and all the kids had grown up and left home and stuff. I think these days there's a changing nature of medical workforce with more mature people going in. So they're already in medicine with a mortgage and the partner and the kids. So it's more difficult to get them away from, you know, bigger cities where they perceive education opportunities and the like.
We'll take a break for another song in just a moment.
You're with Rebecca McLaren.
Rebecca McLaren.
It's wonderful to be back home.
On ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
Joined by AMA of the NT President, Dr. Robert Parker, for Old New Borrowed Blue. And we'd better have another song, Robert. What have you chosen for Borrowed?
Again, it's a show of hands copy of an original song by Stan Rogers about the Northwest Passage. Rogers' original song was an a cappella one. Basically, he sang with a bit of accompaniment. The show of hands put it to music. But it's got a lot of relevance these days. It's had a lot of relevance in respect to Indigenous cultural issues and also global warming. The Indigenous stuff, the Franklin Expedition, which the song is about, John Franklin was the Deputy Governor of Tasmania. He adopted a young Aboriginal woman called Mathuni, who he brought into government house and treated as a young lady until he and Lady Franklin left Tasmania, and they just dumped her on the street. She died a hopeless drunk about 3 or 4 years later. Yeah. There was at the Bangarra Dance Company actually did a dance about Mathuni and the tragedy of her life. But so years later, Franklin was appointed to do a scientific expedition to traverse the Northwest Passage. And the entire expedition perished in the Arctic. As much because they just ignored the local Inuit, as when they got trapped on the ice, they ignored the Inuit as a source of information. So Amundsen, who actually did traverse the Northwest Passage, And later went on to be the first person at the South Pole, actually respected the Inuit. So when he actually got trapped, he actually went and lived with them and learned how to live off the ice, build igloos, hunt seal. So there's a significant image in this song about respect for Indigenous culture and what it might do, and almost karma affecting Franklin because of his lack of respect for Indigenous culture. But then there's the other issue now of global warming. Nowadays, tourists can traverse the Northwest Passage because of global warming. When Franklin tried to do it, it was a very dangerous situation because of sea ice in the winter. And it was considered, it was a very important place thing to do because it would have cut the trade between Europe and Asia by months if you could traverse the passage, which is why people were so keen to do it. But now with global warming, it's sort of a regular tourist route because there's no ice there anymore in the summer. So it's as much a symbol of global warming. The song is as much a symbol of global warming as it is about the respect for Indigenous culture.
As president of AMANT, what's an average day? What does that mean? Are you a regular doctor who has to field calls from journalists constantly?
Yeah, I mean, basically, some AMA presidents often have to take a day or two off each week to deal with issues within their state. I mean, the Territory being a very small jurisdiction, things just come up. So an average day for me, I might just be, if a particular item turns up in the news, I might get rung by two or three journalists having to respond to that. But we're trying to pursue themes as well with the government. We've been very concerned over the government constantly telling us they've got no money for any health issues. And we're also aware at the moment that we're currently missing out on about $82 million a year in federal funding through the medical benefit scheme and the pharmaceutical benefit scheme. There was a particularly good study done last year called Is Medicare Fair, which pointed out that the amount of money we're losing, and that we've also got the highest rate of disability in Australia. And so it's important to pursue themes. And I've had a couple of important themes. I'm continuing to pursue the need for a national centre for disease control, and that's because of an ongoing syphilis epidemic in Central Australia that I don't think the government's actually effectively dealt with. And I think there's some issues about the current coronavirus, which I'm not going to comment on, which I think the government could have done better and we'll probably comment on later. And I'm informed by experts in infectious disease who are very concerned about the lack of a Centre for Disease Control in Australia. I think one of my proudest achievements as AMA president has been to lobby for rheumatic heart disease. We ended up producing a report card, or the AMA did, on the rheumatic heart disease, which then led to the formation of the End RHD Coalition. And as a result of lobbying further beyond that, $35 million has been devoted by the federal government to try and develop a vaccine to prevent rheumatic heart disease. And that's been described as a game changer. And that would be one of my proudest achievements if that vaccine's developed and we can actually stop this appalling illness that's affecting Aboriginal kids far ahead of other kids in Australia.
Your studies were at RDH. How has that changed?
Well, again, RDH has grown. When I started off, Cowdy Hall was on the fifth floor of the hospital. It was a much smaller hospital. We only had, I think, two physicians, two surgeons, one psychiatrist, a couple of obstetricians. This was back in 88 when I started as an intern. Nowadays, there's massive numbers of consultants. And again, that's a tribute, I think, to Professor Len Notaris, who's currently heading the trauma centre. But he really helped develop the number of specialists working in the Territory. So it's a much bigger hospital now, much more complex. In the old days, you used to know the medical administrators and Pauline Wilson, who was again a member of a president of the AMA, a remarkably good medical administrator. She was very sensible too. She used to basically have a staff forum every month, basically. But you'd turn up and there'd be tables groaning with food. So everyone would fill themselves up and be sort of sitting there with a significant sense of satisfaction from too much food. And then she'd say, are there any problems? So she was obviously, Pauline was very good for psychology as well.
One way to do it. With your Tiwi family, how have you seen life on Tiwi change?
Unfortunately, there's been a lot of sadness. I mean, a lot of substance abuse, a lot of pressure now from substances, particularly cannabis. I mean, I was particularly concerned with alcohol and the effect on Tiwis when I was there in my craft advisor days, and I could actually see the effect of alcohol. But nowadays, I mean, substances have taken over. There's a lot of issues. I mean, my daughter Stacey, eldest daughter Stacey, has been the secretary of the school there for 20 years. I'm very proud of what she's achieved in terms of contributing to Tiwi education. So, and obviously she has worked with Sister Anne. So I think there's some really good things happening on Tiwi in terms of developing education and looking for the future. But at the same time, there's a lot of pressures in the community, which I'm constantly aware of because of what's happened to my wife's relatives and their predicaments in life. So I can work with that. Yeah.
Is it still a lovely place to go back for celebrations?
I haven't been there for a long time, to be frank. You know, I should go back more. But yeah, there's some good things there.
Is that because you're busy or?
Oh, yeah. I think there's a particular purpose. I think it's getting more access to a boat so I can go fishing. And that takes a lot of organisation.
So that's one of the things you love about life in the Territory?
Well, fishing's marvellous. I mean, some of the best days I've had up here have been fishing up Dunamary, which I'm not sure if it's still operating, but a group of us went out of Dunamary one day and between the six of us, I think we picked up, this is before the bag limits, by the way, we picked up 14 jewies. We were triple ganging gold brim snapper. That was a very good day. And I always remember going out with one of my wife's relatives on Tiwi, and we went to a creek, and you had to be there at a particular bend in the creek at a particular time. And we were there and we were just hauling in mangrove jacks, and they were about a metre in size. And they weren't just jiggling the hook, they were just jumping on the hook. And we suddenly had a boat full of mangrove jack. And then one of the party snagged, and as he was pulling off the snag, basically hooked up to a metre of barramundi. So, you know, that was, and my ex-boss, Raphael, turned up about 10 minutes later and missed out totally. He was very disappointed in another boat. So, yeah, it was a good day, that one.
So you were there waiting at the right spot for the right time.
The right tide.
Everything just changed.
Yeah, it was brilliant. Yeah, it was amazing. So, yeah, there's been some good days.
In fact,
one of my pinnacle moments. I used to have a boat on Tiwi when I was there as a craft advisor. And I always remember coming back down the strait one evening and the sun was setting over the west and the water was almost totally still. And with the sun setting over the strait, it was almost like going through liquid gold. As though the boat was slowly making its way. And because it was just making its way through molten gold, it was just amazing. Yeah, beautiful experience.
It's time for your blue song. Robert, what have you chosen?
Well, I've chosen Preaching Blues by Robert Johnson. Robert Johnson had a particular effect on me. I mean, I've written a play about Robert Johnson, which was performed in Sydney and in New Zealand many years ago. I've got a particular concordance of interest with Matt Cocker.
Is there anything you can't do? Do you play instrument?
No, I don't, unfortunately. Matt Cocker used to run your program in the evenings. He had a particular interest in Robert Johnson, and Matt and I got to know each other a bit in his later years. In fact, I actually visited a couple of years ago. I visited Robert Johnson's grave in Greenwood, Mississippi, and as much a tribute to Matt as Mac as myself, you know. And it was a very moving experience to find this lonely churchyard with a tree and Robert Johnson's grave under the tree. No one actually knew where he was buried for many years. It was a bit like the Mozart of rock and roll. Oh. He was in a grave, and then fortunately, the wife of the grave digger in her 90s was able to confirm that his grave. So there's a formal grave there now, and everyone visits. There's guitar picks, bottles of beer, everything sort of sitting around the grave. So it was a particularly moving moment to be at the foot of the master.
And why this song?
Again, Preaching Blues is one of Robert Johnson's great songs. It's sort of described as the rock and roll Robert Johnson song.
Thank you so much for spending time and sharing stories and music with me tonight. Robert, it's been fantastic.
My pleasure.
ABC Radio, Darwin.
Don't forget that.